When the Brian Dickey era, and I think that's a serious enough term for a serious enough era that we can use it, when the Brian Dickey era at Chicago Opera Theater came to an end, and we'll fill you in on all the chronology in a moment, Brian said to me, "How about an exit interview?" I thought, well, I've been thinking along those lines, but I didn't want to use that phrase. But Brian being Brian, he had no problem with that. So here we are, a few weeks after Brian actually has left Chicago, boo-hoo, 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 in a small window of time while he is in Chicago for the opening of the last production that he put together for COT, but the first production that will be supervised by his successor, The Magic Flute, the first one in Chicago, new by any company in some 17 years, we are now having a chance to do the Brian Dickey exit interview. Brian, we miss you already.
Well, I didn't think so. I miss you too. You know, Chicago's, because I was here for so long, 13 years, which is quite a long time, some sort of quarter of my career or something of that kind, it is a huge length of time. And I didn't sort of realize it when I came here that I would stay for so long. But 13 years have passed. I've had the most marvelous, marvelous time, made so many extraordinary friends. And we've done some great work, I think, on the whole. And And I miss you. But I have to move on, as they say.
You're good with number things that I'm not. I think you probably have off the top of your head some of the numbers. It's an extraordinary number of productions, new productions, etc. Do you know any of those things, even approximately off the top of your head?
Well, 13 years, let's say we did 3 new productions a year for 12 of those years, so that's 36, but then 2 or 3 of them came from other places. So let's say we did 32, 33 new productions. It's actually quite a lot of new productions, because most opera companies do a small handful of new productions each year and do a lot of revivals.
Right.
And some of the smaller companies rent things in from other places and cobble them together and put them on, and that's just fine. But it's not, in fact, what CAT has done. We've tended to choose pieces which needed to be done here, but which hadn't actually, in many cases, been done in any company in North America, or not in many companies, and probably not in companies that would be able to provide them to us at an economic price to fit into the Harris Theatre. So by and large, we've originated all the work, and of course that has given one a huge amount of freedom. One has been able to choose the directors and the designers and the singers to put together a package and work with them for a nice long rehearsal period, preparation period, typically 4 to 5 weeks, which is a lot, actually, by North American standards.
North American opera standards.
North American opera standards. And it meant that we were able to put a huge amount more detail, perhaps, into the work than is typically the case. And so everything we did, by and large, was from scratch. And that's the way I like to work.
Yeah.
I suppose that's the way I've always worked, having started off at Glyndebourne all those years ago, where we always did our own thing. Always 2 new productions a year and 3 or 4 productions which were repeated from just recent years. And so it was all very much the house production.
Right. And there becomes an enhanced sense, not that other houses don't have this, but there becomes an enhanced sense of family and ownership when each production is from the house.
I think so. I mean, I think, you know, there are many much trumpeted virtues of co-production, which tend largely to be involved with money. Surprise, surprise. But what comes with that, you pay a bit of a price for that, in that, in fact, you can end up by, not exactly a committee process, but there is a great degree tendency to accommodate quite reasonably other people's points of view, so it can lose a certain definition. And actually, in the case of COT, whenever we've been involved in a new production, those productions have always cost us more than had we done them ourselves in the first place. On the other hand, we got more for our money, right, if you like. I mean, for example, The Nixon in China, which we did in collaboration with the Opera Theatre of St. Louis and 2 or 3 other partners. There's no way in which we could have done anything like that on our own. But nevertheless, our costs of doing it, I think it's still the most expensive production we've done. Mm. I think it cost us something like $800,000, which was much more than typically we would have spent. And that was in 2006.
Right.
But even the rental that we did of the Glimmerglass, what was it, Semele, about 10 years ago now, that cost us more than had we done it from scratch. So, you know, it's better actually decide what you're going to do with the resource, you know, define your canvas,
right,
and, as it were, paint within the margins that you have set.
And that pretty much characterizes what you've done throughout your career and what you've done here in Chicago. You saw there's lyric, they do this and they do this. Let's go into the areas of what they don't do, things earlier in the repertoire, things more recent in the repertoire, and some things written for smaller houses, such as the works of Benjamin Britten.
Exactly. Well, I mean, when I came here, I mean, I considered my job was to be another, well, the COT's job is to be another opera provider. Lyric typically would do 8 operas a year, which is a tiny, tiny number of pieces. And we were planning to move downtown, which we eventually got there in February of 2004. And my initial job really was to shape the company to become an additional opera provider for the opera audience in this city, which was restricted at this point in terms of first-class quality work to 8 productions a year.
And to a certain slice of the calendar.
And inevitably, because of the huge volume of the Lyric Opera's house, it was restricted to 19th century stuff and 20th century things, big things. Some Handel, of course they did. And I mean, years and years ago, I think with John Vickers and the role of Nero, they did the Coronation of Beaupère,
right.
I think around 1966.
Right.
But typically, Monteverdi would not be seen there. They did a handful of Handel and really well too, but we looked at the dramatic oratorios and the Semele and this kind of thing in English. And then we moved on to Agrippina, and then we did Risorazione, and then Orlando, and most recently, of course, Tasio. So Handel was very important for us. Monteverdi was very important for us, and these were filling gaps. And Benjamin Britten, the smaller scale operas of Benjamin Britten, because only Billy Budd and Peter Grimes could really be done at Lyric. And to bring Owen Wingrave and to bring Death in Venice and to do productions of The Rape of Lucretia, which had been seen here before, and The Turn of the Screw likewise had been seen. But to do A Midsummer Night's Dream, we gave the Chicago premiere of, remarkably, I mean, yeah. in 2005. When was it written? 1961 or something. So that was great to have done that. And then bringing John Adams. First of all, the co-production with Opera Theatre of St. Louis, and then bringing the absolutely, I think, delicious Flowering Tree, mm-hmm. and with John himself conducting it. This was all so exhilarating for us, and I think it made us totally relevant,
right.
and validated our position as a provider of first-class opera in the city.
One of the things that was a part of that arc of both redefinition and growth and then focus and expansion of that focus was your ability to tap in to young talent. And I phrase it that way because it's not only, which is a remarkable ability by itself, it's not only that you could hear a young singer in a competition or an audition and say, I think she's got some potential to do X, Y, and Z. It's that you could hear a singer and think, I think this person could go into this whole part of the repertoire. Or here's a stage director who has never done to and maybe never even been to an opera. And she or he might very well become a major figure in this field. So that's much more than just hearing a good voice and stopping and turning and plucking that person.
Yeah, you know, I was very fortunate. I began my career at the age of 20 at Glyndebourne, working really 24/7, it's very, very little time to myself, working for the Hungarian head of music staff and music preparation there. And it was there that I really learned the rigor, which I discovered to be absolutely essential when one was doing this kind of work. Glyndebourne was a very special place for all kinds of reasons, but one of the earliest sort of responsibilities that I took on was when I was only 22, 23 years old, was to really manage the recruitment of the chorus.
Mm-hmm.
And the Glyndebourne chorus had always been composed of the most gifted young singers that could be found in England. You know, Peter Pears had been a member of that mm-hmm. chorus, for example, and Janet Baker and Heather right. Harper, all kinds of distinguished singers in the past. So there was that tradition. Of course, at that time, there was no Scottish Opera. There was Welsh National Opera was a sort of semi-professional company. There was no Opera North. And so opera provision around the country was not very great, and there weren't so many employment opportunities for gifted young singers. And we found all these youngsters, and they were in the chorus, and they did understudies. And then, of course, in 1967, we started Blindborn Touring Opera, which provided opera all around the country in places where they did not have opportunity to see it. But most importantly, we used our understudies from the festival to sing the major roles, bumped them all up a notch.
Right.
And I was bumped up a notch from being a 25-year-old sort of minor official to becoming administrator of this thing at the age of 26, something like that. And at the same time, I'd just been appointed artistic director of the Wexford Festival, because Walter Legg, who'd been appointed to succeed its founder, had a heart attack, whether as a result of looking at the first budget or what, I don't know. I think he had generally had a seizure of some kind. But at any rate, I stepped into the breach, so I suddenly had these two jobs, which provided me with a very considerable challenge of finding gifted young singers of the highest quality who would come for nothing, relatively speaking, no money. And I've done that for 50 years.
Right.
And so, I mean, it's in my DNA, I guess.
Yeah.
So for me, it's not particularly a problem. It's what I do.
Right.
And to the extent that I've done it successfully, that's been great. I've made huge mistakes, I'm sure, over the years. But there it is. I think we've got a pretty good track record at Blindborn and at Wexford and also in Canada when I was at the Canadian Opera Company. And
it also, in Chicago, allowed you to fit into something that I think is also a part of your nature, and that is institutional connection and collaboration. Here you know how to work with young singers. You know which ones can fit. And there was the Lyric Opera Center for American Artists, now the Ryan Center, and there was Roosevelt University, Chicago Musical College, now Chicago College for Performing Arts. And here comes somebody not from either place, and he says, oh, why don't we just fit these three things together?
Yeah, well,
everybody benefits.
Well, that's, again, you say, that's part, something I've done all my life. I mean, in England, as a young, very young man, I mean, I made those connections to the Royal Northern College of Music in Manchester, the Guildhall School of Music, the Royal College of Music, and the Royal Academy of Music in London. And that was, after all, this is where the young singers come from.
Right.
And each year, there's a new vintage. Some take a little bit longer to mature, but you have to identify those bottles, as it were,
right,
and keep an eye on them. I mean, Daniel Denisa, who emerged onto the operatic scene in 2005 as a sort of mini-sensation, which she continued to do, I first heard her when she was 19, mm-hmm. in 1999 at the Metropolitan Opera. I marked her out to be watched.
Right.
That is what one does.
Right.
TBW, or TBHA, to be heard again.
Okay, write those down.
Or sometimes, sometimes never again.
N-A.
Well, N-A is also another shorthand for not available, unfortunately.
Okay.
But the fact is that you've got to keep track. You have to see people as their talent flowers and burgeons, and then swoop at the right moment when you think you've got just the thing for them. And in the case of Danny, it was Popper in it for the opening of our first season in the Harris Theatre in February of 2004. And but I mean, that's just one example of amongst many. It requires, I mean, I'm not saying it comes, it does really come easily to me in the sense that it's an intuitive, instinctive thing. I think it's really important to be able to tell the difference between the good and the best. You know, the old saying is the good is the enemy of the best. And, or, you know, good enough is good enough. Well, good enough is not good enough.
Right.
I mean, you have to be extremely patient when you're putting a production together and really have faith that something will turn up. I mean, it's not going to turn out by itself. You have to work at it and just inquire, and think deeply and watch what's going on and talk to people. you know, all these great ideas that we may seem to have had, they're as a result of relationships I have with so many people in the business. Nobody knows it all, and I don't know it all, but I talk to my colleagues and I give them tips, and they give me tips, and we proceed from there.
We are getting some wonderful tips from Brian Dickey, who for 13 years, was general director of Chicago Opera Theater and oversaw its move downtown to the Harris Theater for Music and Dance, and also played a tremendous role in the opera world and in the Chicago scene for that time, and before that in the opera world and the world scene as well in Canada, at Wexford in Southern Ireland, and of course at Glyndebourne, where he was a part of a golden age of opera presentation and opera spreading the gospel, really, of all of that. But you didn't just do that, and you don't just do that with singers. You've done this as well with the people who do the stage side. And, of course...
Yeah, I guess conductors, too.
And conductors, yeah. Right. So where does that come from? How did you find that... How did you decide
did
that
I
Diane Paulus would...
It was a very funny story. When I was Nice, as advisor to the director of the Nice Opera, who was really a dance man, so, I mean, I told him what to do about opera, but, I mean, you know, he relied to a certain extent on me. André Serban came to do a production of Thais, which actually René Fleming I had originally cast in, and René got an ear infection, so she didn't make it. But anyway, André came, and he brought with him a former student of his at Columbia University, Diane Paulus. And we became friendly, and, you know, he was usual sort of socializing in the French cafes after rehearsals and after performances. We became really quite friendly. So anyway, when the whole process came to an end, she went back to New York, but I made a note of her address. And this would have been about, I guess, 1997, 98. Then when I came here in the fall of 99, I was reading the New York Times one day, and there was a piece about off-Broadway gifted young director.
Off-Broadway
it was, because it was all to do with the donkey show in this nightclub. And Diane was one of the half dozen people who was featured. And I thought, oh, I know that woman. Yes, yes. And so I looked her up in my database, my address book, as it were, but it was an electronic one even in those days. And sure enough, I had a phone number for her. And since she was married and stable and had a sort of proper sort of foundation to her life, she was still there at her old address.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, because often people just
disappear
into the, right. into the ether. So I called her, and we had a lovely chat. I said, look, I'm going to be in New York next week. I've got an idea I want to discuss with you. And Mary Zimmerman, who I'd invited to direct the Orfeo, wasn't able to do it. Or I can't remember why, but I think she wanted to do it, but she wasn't available. So I had a sort of vacancy there. And also I wanted to find somebody who would really work well with Jane Glover, who was going to conducting. And I had this sort of feeling that Jane and Diane would be a really, really good pair. They had very much the same considerable intellect. Jane has got a very, very wide range of intellectual interests, and in theatre in particular, and I just felt that they would really click. So I talked to Diane about this, and I got them to meet a week or two after we'd met in New York, and they did absolutely click.
Now, I have to interject that it takes intuition and insight to make that kind of a connection, because on the surface, aside from their intellect and work ethic, someone who didn't know them or didn't know what to look for might probably not make that connection.
Well, no, but I did know them. I'd known Jade for years and
right.
years.
Right.
And Diane I got to know reasonably well, but in a very short time.
Right.
So I questioned and we talked about it, and it became clear to me that there was a potential
right.
here at
right.
any rate. And so they met, and the rest is history, as it were.
Literally.
I mean, they then ended up by doing the three Monteverdis, the three Da Pontes of Mozart. They did Turn of the Screw, of course, together as well. And so it was a very, very successful bit of serendipitous sort of thing, that. So I put them together, and... You know, I like to build teams. I don't like to think in terms of an opera season, one season at a time. Mm-hmm. I like to think a sort of arc of curatorship of the repertory, but also of the participants, so that there's a body of work that you can that they create. Sometimes you make a mistake, so you've got to abandon somebody. But by and large, if you land on a good team, if you get them to do two or three things together, it can be good. And in the case of Jane and Diane, they did 7 productions, I think it was.
And they've gone on to do things elsewhere too.
Exactly. And you know, with Ken Kazan, with The Death in Venice and the Erd Wingrave, that worked extremely well, that he came back with his designer to do those two productions. And Stuart Bedford, of course, he's conducting the flute now, and conducted the Erd Wingrave. So this question of directors, yes. This young man, James Darrow, who I met.
How did you find him? I mean, that's a really young...
Well, it was Peter Cazares, who, again, I've known forever, since he was a tenor years ago, and he's such a hugely successful teacher now, and both in L.A. and in Seattle. And James was one of his sort of protégés.
Right.
I mean, just to give him his due, I mean, he's not the only one that James is a protege of, because Stephen Wadsworth has been another enormously important influence in James's life. But I met James when he was 26 or 27. And I just liked so much his attitude, his real understanding and appreciation of the sort of repertory that I thought that I wanted to use him for. And so he did these two super productions, and I'm sure he's going to go on to great things.
Yes.
But going back further, of course, I mean, Simon Rattle came onto our music staff at Glyndebourne in 1975, and I think I hired him when he was 18. And he, as assistant to Bernard Haitink and Raymond Leppard on the new productions of the year 2005, and I'm not sure that I confessed that he was 18 at the time. In fact, he was 20 by the time we started work, but prodigiously gifted. And of course, Andrew Davies started his operatic career at Glyndebourne as a member of the music staff in 73. All a long time ago, and they were marvellous days, these young people who are, they're all, I mean, Andrew's a bit younger than me, Simon's about what at the time was a huge age difference, because I was 34 and he was 20, and he considered me to be an old ogre, you know, Simon. But that's what one does. One looks around and tries to find the very, very best, mm-hmm. and tries to seek out the most excellent elements that you possibly can, be they directors, conductors, singers, and obviously repertory as well. I'm not a great one for scraping the bottom of the barrel. I mean, I think it's really important to feel good about the real quality of these pieces which have been not performed or underperformed. You know, because I did that in Wexford, introduced pieces which hadn't been heard of by anybody. I mean, Romeo and Juliet in those days, in 1967, was a piece which was never done.
Right.
So my first year at Wexford, we did Rossini's, we had a Shakespeare, Rossini's Otello and Gounod's Romeo and Juliet. So that's just been my life, trying to seek out really excellent elements to put on top-class performances for not just connoisseur opera goers, but people of discrimination who really care about the art form.
There's a flip side to that too, and that is, while some of the reasons can be monetary or take the fish that are swimming nearby, whatever else you might want to call them, you've also worked to create apprentice programs so that there might then be people for you to find or for others to find. What is it you talked about you've gotten from hearing these people, recognizing a talent that you could use and work with and collaborate with? But when you work with the people who are just before that point, the apprentices or the young artists, whatever name the groups might have, what is it that you try to impart to them? What is it that you try to get them to focus on?
Well, I've always taken the view that young people, when they start out in their professional life, be they as lawyers or doctors or opera singers or anybody working in our business, what really defines what they finally achieve or affects what they finally achieve are the role models they have and the people that they're working with in their 20s. So I've always sought to create an environment, a situation where young singers coming into the company can be inspired by the quality of the colleagues that they're working with, the older colleagues. Older, like 30 instead of 25, you know. Right. So and also creating working conditions which are, as it were, the gold standard, the state of the art, the best practice. So what we do not do at COT, we never did at COT, if we could possibly avoid it, and we did avoid it almost entirely, was to throw productions on in the way, you know, cutting corners here and there with time, not enough time in the rehearsal room, putting the cart before the horse, not doing proper musical preparation, not having enough stage and orchestra time. I mean, we do provide a slightly luxurious environment compared with other companies, particularly in North America. But I think
not financially luxurious. Well, but luxurious in terms of the commitment.
Well, it costs
the time.
Money to, you know, it does cost money to have extra orchestra time.
Sure, but you've made a choice to use that you had for that.
Exactly. I mean, at the end of the day, there are two bottom lines in an artistic enterprise. The financial bottom line has to be in credit, and the artistic bottom line has to be, if you're bankrupt on either side of those, of that sort of balance sheet, as it were, then you're in serious trouble. Now, of course, COT, like so many opera companies, has always had a frightful financial problem. But we have, I think, kept to the principle that the pursuit of excellence is what we are really about. And we must not, at all costs, compromise that. Whenever we've had to make cuts, and very often we've had to make cuts, my principle has been that they must be both inaudible and invisible, even to the most discerning eye and ear. And by and large, I mean, we haven't always succeeded completely in that regard, because there's always just somebody who really notices. But on the whole, I think we've been rather good in our pursuit of the creative minimalism, which has resulted in quality work, which has been appreciated, but on quite small resources.
I think this is important to go back again to how we started this section of the discussion, and that is to impress upon young people that learning from the right people and participating in a group with people who don't make compromises, that's something that they need to learn so that they will be at their best.
That's right.
Well, it seems obvious, but it's not done by many people.
Well, no, but I mean, if you can teach them in the early stages of their career what the best practice is, then when they go to other places and they find that the conditions are just not up to it, they will make their voices heard, I expect, right, in most cases. They say, this isn't up to us, and they won't go back. Many, many young singers that I've come across who have started their careers with us and in other excellent places, when they go to some companies, they find the conditions are so awful that they don't want to go back. And there's a very, very famous singer. I won't name him, but I bumped into him at the stage door of the Scala, and he was singing a major Wagnerian role there, and it was a total shambles. And I said to him, how do you do it? He said, well, it's the money. That's why, you know, some of these houses pay these colossal fees. So there's a degree of degree of cynicism around. But for the youngsters, it is so terribly important that they learn the best practices, because then they will pursue quality and excellence and become much more rigorous in their approach to their own preparation. They will be equipped, and they will be able to do, they will know how to behave.
They'll know how to contribute and how to be recognized.
Yeah, exactly.
We can't have this discussion without talking about the area that is the wall that magnetically grabs the head of anybody who wants to run a musical organization, an opera company in the current world economic and local American and Chicago economic climate, and that is getting the money to do this sort of thing. How does somebody persuade a fortunate city, a city that has problems but has plenty of people with good-sized bank accounts, that this work is important and that a gift that might be small compared to a gift to the Chicago Symphony Orchestra or the Lyric Opera of Chicago or the Art Institute of Chicago can be a really institution-building gift for something on the size of a COT?
Well, I'm not sure I'm the right person to ask this, because, I mean, I haven't had nearly as much success in this regard as I would like to have had. I regret terribly that I've been unable to actually put COT on a really solid financial footing. But it's been a bad period. But I don't think I've been nearly as good at it as other people.
But what might we learn from what you learned from not being as good at this one area as you've been in so many other areas?
That it's very difficult. No, I'm sure my successor is going to be very good in certain respects about this, and I desperately hope that he is. He's got enormous charm and persuasive abilities, I think probably greater than mine.
They're different kinds of charm and they're different kinds of persuasive abilities, and maybe it just takes somebody who has the ones for the rehearsal room and the ones for the dinner pitch.
Yeah, I think that at the end of the day, the most important thing is that you're going to ride on the excellence of the work that you do. And opera is supported by people who love opera, who understand that the very highest standards cost money. They want the best in this city, and they're prepared to push the boat out. And we've got a number of really, really wonderfully generous and understanding donors, and I'm sure they will be remaining with the company, and the trick is to add to them.
Right.
And some of them we've had and we've lost, and the trick will be to get them back.
Right, right.
Somebody with more diplomatic skills than me may be able to do that, and I hope so. Because, you know, I'm a fairly impatient fellow. And I sort of put people's noses out to join from time to time. I'm sure, you know, I've offended a number of people. I'm absolutely certain about that.
Sure. I know I have.
Sure.
And so that's a weakness, but it's a fact.
But that same impatience and those same demands, as we were just saying, can work extremely well when the door to the theater is closed and the work before a production is being done. And the putty, which the young performers are, is there to be shaped and shaped for good. Take those same traits, and they just might not work with somebody who says, look here, Dickie, I know how you ought to run your opera company. Why, I've been a business consultant now for 18 years.
That's right. And what's more, I can run the country. I should want to be president. So we shall see. It's a fine balancing act.
Yeah.
And it's very difficult being the second opera company in a city.
Right. Well, if we had to have one set of intuitions and abilities that worked 98.7%, let's say, of the time, I'm glad we've had them on the artistic side. I mean, yes, of course, it would have been great to have had more of it on the business side, the financial side. But if there had to be a choice, and I'm not saying there did, but just fate makes different people in different ways, I would have much rather we had somebody doing things in the way that you did than somebody who could absolutely present a beautiful fundraising package and balanced budget each season, but with work that was dull or uninteresting or unsuccessful.
That's right, Andrew. I mean, you know, the quality of the work is a sort of sine qua non, but at the same time, if we can't get the money right, that's fatal as well.
Sure.
So, but we're still here.
Right.
And this company, but there's enough.
You haven't handed off something that is in tatters by any means. You've handed off something that needs a lot of infusion.
Yeah.
But everything does.
Yes. Now, I'm absolutely confident. We've got a fantastic board, I have to get into the habit of saying, and they have the most wonderful board of dedicated people who are absolutely determined to see that this company flourishes and goes from strength to strength.
And you've built up an audience base and a subscriber base that were not there, and that other companies in many fields have found it very hard to do. And, of course, that none of this means that all the work isn't out there. But you do have somebody coming in who has run a similar-sized company in a place that's artistically, in some ways, not as beneficial, I don't know, or benefited. Long Beach is not Chicago and vice versa. So if somebody can make it there, as Mr. Sinatra says, perhaps he can make it elsewhere. What's coming up for you now?
Well, I'm continuing to do my Bertelsmann Foundation.
Tell us about that.
Well, since actually just before I came here in 99, I've been, they call me director of auditions for this biennial singing competition, which takes me all around the world, hearing the best young singers in Asia sometimes in Australia, South America, Central America, all around Europe, Central Europe, Western Europe, Eastern Europe, and selecting out of about 1,000 of the best young singers that I hear, 40 to go to the finals of this competition, which is in October each year. The competition is called Neue Stimmen, and I'm going to be continuing to do that. An actual
New voices.
Neue Stimmen. And I'll be continuing to do that and probably expanding my actually work with them to a certain extent, but it's still only a biennial competition. There are various other ideas in the air, which I may or may not have time to do, but I certainly want to do other things. But I've got 9 grandchildren and 1 quite young daughter, as well as 3 quite grown-up parents of these 9 grandchildren. And they're all in England, right. So I get to be able to see much more of them.
Yeah.
And but I'm not giving up, far from it. My blog has gone into a sort of slightly quiet period.
But it will reemerge.
But it's going to burst into action right. Very soon.
I have no doubt. Again. Burst into action is a good way to describe Brian Dickey, I think. That's what the B stands for, yes. Brian. What are some of the things that you've learned from this experience in Chicago and in the United States? I mean, obviously, you brought a lot with you. Now, there might be a different way of looking at what one has learned from a 13-year period if one were leaving at the age of 40 or the age of 50. But still, I imagine there are things that you learned from this experience, too, as well as things you provided or tested and built on.
Well, I'd learned a certain amount during my 5 years in Canada.
Right.
And I know Canada and the U.S. are not quite the same.
Right. But there vis-a-vis Europe, there's a similarity, probably.
Yes. And I think a sort of extension of what I learned in Canada was the absolutely critical importance of the passionate opera lover, donor, being really the lifeblood of these companies. I didn't, before I went to Canada, realize the extent to which that was absolutely fundamental, and it's even more fundamental in the United States and in Canada, where there is still support from the Canada Council, you know, the Canadian government and the provincial government. But it's really, in the end, down to the passionate opera lovers who have disposable money to give away to the things that they really, really love. And also the expectation that even the ordinary ticket buyer is prepared to give a little extra to the extent that they can. This is something which is completely alien to us in Britain and Europe. Small donations are very, very, very few and far between. Most people consider once they bought their ticket, that's it. That is beginning to change somewhat, but it's been absolutely an essential component for the financing of arts organizations in America for generations.
Right.
I have also learned that actually taking shortcuts, which some of my dear colleagues in other places take, are, if not fatal, are extremely damaging.
You had an instinct in that direction before, but you learned your instinct was right.
I've grown up with never, ever, you know, the old thing that John Christie's wife said to him before Glyndebourne was even built was, for God's sake, John, if you're going to do this, do it properly. Which meant that you really actually have to do everything as well as you possibly can and not take shortcuts. And I've seen the kind of short-term shortcutting around about the place, which is extremely damaging. I instinctively felt that, but having seen the evidence, I'm more than ever determined that one should not compromise.
Brian Dickey, I've said this before, and I'm going to say it again in front of you this time. One, I have to tell you, I mean, I know a lot of people. I'm fortunate to meet a lot of people and talk with a lot of people, but in these 13 years, you've really become one of my favorite people in the world, not just in the world of opera. I think you've given us so much in Chicago, and you've given the artists so much, hundreds of them, who are still now approaching, in many cases, their golden time in their career. So that's something that's going to carry on for a very long time. You know, when towards the end of Schulte's time in Chicago, he said, famously or infamously, as the case may be, they should build a statue to me. And of course they did, and it's not a very flattering or fetching statue or likeness, but I do think they should build a statue to you, Brian, and I think that perhaps the best would be one of those wonderful coat hanger wires that Alexander Calder made his circuses out of, and I think it should be the ringmaster. And you've been an uncompromising but always jolly, always insightful, and always generous ringmaster in Chicago, both at COT and in all of the other groups you've connected with and been involved with. And I've learned again much just from this exit interview, to use your term, here. And I hope that we'll be seeing the ringmaster back in Chicago, and also benefiting from the many projects that you're embarking on now with London again as your base. Thank you so much for taking the time on this brief visit in mid-September back to Chicago to talk with us, and best wishes to you in all that you're going to continue to pursue.
Thank you, Andrew. You've been a fantastic friend and colleague, and I'm hugely grateful, and Operatic Chicago is hugely grateful to you for the noise you make in support of really, really hard, serious work. So bless you. Thank you very much indeed.
I appreciate the idea that somebody recognizes that I'm making noise, because that's what I do. Unfortunately, WFMT and the Sun-Times let me do that. Thank you so much again, Brian.
Thank you.
Some say they saw him at a much later day, sipping a drink at a little cafe. And others will swear he was seen on the street and lost in the crowd before they could meet. Schweig, Schweig, the good soldier Schweig, the kind of fellow that fellow men like. In one place or other, he's sure to be found. I wouldn't be surprised if he's somewhere around.
Music that we heard this evening, beginning with the very beginning of the Dickey era, the world premiere recording of Robert Kurka's The Good Soldier Schweig. Chicago Opera Theater recorded this for Sadie Records, released in 2002. The expert conducting of former COT music advisor and resident conductor Alexander Platt, opening the program with the Overture to Same, recorded April 2001 at Bennett Gordon Hall up at Ravinia in Highland Park. Midway through the conversation with Brian Dickey, you heard two selections from a great Dickey championee, discoveree, Danielle Denise. We first heard Danny with countertenor Andreas Scholl, recorded in the High Alsace of France in January 2011. Purtimiro from Monteverdi's The Incoronation of Poppea. Of course, this was one of the things that really helped both Denise and COT explode on the local, national, and world scenes back when. And then from Xerxes, or Circe of Handel, recorded at St. Jude on the Hill in Hampstead, North London, in April of 2010, the Largo, Ombra, My Fou, both of those with another great Dickie connection, Harry Bickett and the English Concert, both of those on the Decca label. And then a little Philip to close, the epilogue of Good Soldier Schweik, Mark Embry narrating The Gentleman of Bohemia, Alexander Platt conducting Chicago Opera Theater. Our exit interview with Brian Dickey was conducted on Friday the 14th of September at the Radisson Blue Hotel in the Aqua Building in the New East Downtown, whatever they're calling it here in Chicago. And Brian Dickey, befitting a Roman senator or maybe an emperor, had flown in just for 30-some hours to see the opening night of Magic Flute, his last selected and cast production here at COT in Chicago, and he was lying on his back as we spoke. And that was a very lovely scene and setting. The recording of said interview was by Matt DeStefano, who tells me that it actually made it easier to set up the microphones that way, too. Maybe we'll try it with other guests. Matt, of course, is also responsible for post-production as our producer and producing engineer. We'd like to thank Brian Dickey for squeezing this in to a busy international schedule. We'd like to thank our funders, Alpha Wood Foundation, Richard and Susan Kiphart, and other friends of this program. Drop us a line. Rentap, Patner spelled backwards, R-E-N-T-A-P at AOL.com, or the Chime In feature at WFMT.com, where you can chime in. WFMT.com/Critical Thinking, the anytime, anywhere, always free Critical Thinking podcast. I'm Andrew Patner. We'll see you next week.